content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 14th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A brutal week for Trump. What happened? With just over a month until Election Day, Donald Trump endured one of the worst weeks of his presidential campaign with a series of setbacks that included a leaked tax return showing he once lost nearly $1 billion in a year, and an angry feud with a former Venezuelan beauty queen, and a sharp decline in the polls. Three pages of Trump's 1995 tax return, which was anonymously mailed to the New York Times, showed that Trump declared a $916 million net operating loss in 1995, a loss so great he could have legally avoided paying federal income taxes for the next 18 years. The Republican nominee didn't deny that he hadn't paid income taxes during that time and said his deep understanding of the tax laws makes him the only one who can fix them. Hillary Clinton mocked Trump's surrogates, claimed that he was a genius for minimizing his tax exposure, saying, "What kind of genius loses $1 billion in a single year?" In a series of pre-dawn tweets, Trump took Clinton's bait from their first debate and stepped up his attacks on Alicia Machado, the winner of his 1996 Miss Universe competition. Clinton cited Machado in the debate as an example of Trump's sexism, saying the businessman called her Miss Piggy when she gained weight after winning the competition. To get back at Machado for helping the Clinton campaign, the Republican nominee tweeted that the former beauty queen was disgusting, had a shady past, and urged his followers to check out her sex tape, a reference to a racy but non-explicit encounter on a reality TV show. In other developments, Newsweek reported that Trump violated the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba in 1998, and an Associated Press investigation found that he repeatedly demeaned female staff and contestants on The Apprentice with lewd comments about their bodies. Having gone into the first debate almost even with Clinton in the Real Clear Politics national poll average, Trump now trails 48% to 44%. Clinton also regained or expanded her lead in several key battleground states, including Pennsylvania by 4.4 points, Colorado 3.3, and Florida 2.8. Trump still leads in Ohio 2.4 and Iowa 5. What the editorial said: Trump always claims his business acumen makes him uniquely qualified to fix the country's problems, said the New York Times. We can dispense with that fiction now. His $916 million loss, which probably stemmed from his ill-fated entry into the airline business and his disastrous Atlantic City casino empire, represents an epic failure. If he did use the loss to avoid taxes on future income, he wasn't breaking any laws, but he was relying on the government to bail him out of his catastrophically bad business decisions. No ordinary taxpayer can expect a massive handout like that. Let's cut the synthetic shock and outrage, said the Wall Street Journal. Every self-employed American knows business losses are deductible because the cycle of investments and sales isn't confined to a calendar tax year. Nevertheless, the partial release of Trump's tax returns was all too predictable. When he refused to release its returns, he essentially gave an open invitation to hackers and leakers to hit him with an October surprise. Trump's sexist and degrading comments about Machado prove yet again that he is unfit for the Oval Office, said the Los Angeles Times. Trump is simply incapable of overlooking a perceived slight or moderating his response. Those are dangerous qualities in a president. What the columnist said: Years ago, I saw Trump's full tax returns, and they showed that his career is built on sand, said Trump biographer Timothy O'Brien in BloombergView.com. In the 1990s, he overpaid for almost everything he bought. Casinos, hotels, yachts, airlines, you name it. And the notion he is financially sophisticated enough to reform our Byzantine tax code is laughable. In my interviews with him, his eyes glazed over when complex numbers came into play. He relies on accountants and lawyers. Trump's promise to fix the tax code is just another of his brazen lies, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. The tax plan he's released would reduce the tax rate for businesses like Trump's organization to as low as 15%. He's also proposed eliminating the estate tax, which would save the beneficiaries of his will an estimated $7 billion. There's no scandal in Trump's tax return, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. Our tax law permits losses to be carried forward for years for a good reason. It helps keep job-creating businesses afloat. Besides, it's every American's patriotic duty to do everything within the bounds of the law to avoid enriching a wasteful, bloated, and intrusive government. With polls showing Clinton regaining a comfortable lead, Democratic panic is easing, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. She's now essentially where Barack Obama wound up against Mitt Romney in 2012. Clinton is also benefiting from a slow and steady decline in the minor party vote, with Gary Johnson and Jill Stein now combining for less than 10% in poll averages. For those who are terrified by the prospect of a Trump presidency, what this means is that the wolf is still at the door, howling in frustration, and time's running out for the beast to figure out a way to get in. Our controversy of the week, the election. Should Trump revive Bill Clinton's sex scandals? Ready for a sleazy trip back to the 90s, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. After Donald Trump's disastrous first debate against Hillary Clinton, the Republican nominee bragged that he'd shown great restraint in not raising extremely rough questions about former President Bill Clinton's sex life. Now that he's trailing in the polls with the election only weeks away, Trump has evidently changed his mind and is signaling he'll go there in the next debate. All week, Trump's media surrogates have hammered Hillary for supposedly enabling her husband's past indiscretions and helping him smear his accusers. In one bizarre and rambling speech this week, Trump even suggested that Hillary was not loyal to Bill, adding, "Why would she be?" This new focus on the Clintons' marriage is an odd strategic move for Trump, said Michelle Goldberg in Slate.com. Given his own history of proud adultery, womanizing, and sexual harassment. In addition, Hillary has never been more popular than she was at the height of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, when she had a 67% approval rating from a sympathetic public that rightly viewed her as a victim. It's hard to imagine justice quite so poetic than for a raging misogynist like Trump to lose an election while trying to blame a woman for being cheated on. This is about Hillary's behavior, not Bill's, said Mercedes Schlapp in WashingtonTimes.com. She has been accused of calling her husband's mistresses bimbos and either helped or stood by as her husband's aides belittled and smeared Lewinsky, Paula Jones, Jennifer Flowers, Juanita Broderick, et al. The Clintons got away with that in the 90s, said Dylan Matthews in Vox.com. But sexual harassment is taken far more seriously today. Millennial women who were too young to remember the impeachment saga may recoil at the thought of a president sleeping with a White House intern and of a first lady whose first instinct was to tell friends that the accuser was a narcissistic looney tune. Forget Lewinsky, said Daniel Flynn in Spectator.org. Sordid though it was, her affair with the president was at least consensual. More disturbing are the allegations by multiple women that Bill Clinton sexually assaulted them. There is a Bill Cosby quality to the stories that makes Hillary's possible involvement far more troubling, if she knowingly helped cover up her husband's crimes. Yes, but decades have passed since all those allegations were made, said Ramesh Ponuru in BloombergView.com. At the time, Trump himself dismissed the Lewinsky affair as totally unimportant and suggested Clinton should have chosen hotter mistresses. If Trump thinks he can hurt Hillary by talking about marital infidelity, he will only get hit with a boomerang. It wouldn't be the first time that those pointing fingers at the Clintons turned out to be hypocrites, said Laura Kipnis in Vox.com. During the impeachment hearings, two Republican House speakers were forced to step down after they were exposed as adulterers. They were replaced by Dennis Hastert, later revealed to be a serial child molester. How fitting that we should be hearing the same fake outrage today from Donald Trump, a thrice-married admitted adulterer, and his chief surrogate, Rudolph Giuliani, who shocked his second wife by announcing at a press conference he was dumping her for another woman. To have these sexist dinosaurs question Hillary's feminist credentials is a joke. She spent decades fighting for reproductive choice, workplace equality, and women's rights worldwide. You say she should have been nicer to the women boffing her husband? I say, get some perspective. Time for our good week, bad week shorts. It was a good week for bartering. After a restaurant in Australia offered free hamburgers for life to any customer willing to get a life-size tattoo of one of their signature burgers permanently inked to their skin. To date, we've had over 3,000 applicants, said Cafe 51's Steve Agi. It was a good week for Bill Gates, who was number one in Forbes magazine's annual ranking of the country's 400 richest citizens for the 23rd consecutive year. The Microsoft founder has a net worth of $81 billion. Donald Trump dropped 35 spots to 156 behind 14 immigrants. It was a good week for dirty tricks after Iran's news agency reported that a mystery assassin in Iraq slipped poison into ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's hummus, leaving him and three aides desperately ill. But it was a bad week for Southern Californians, who were put on edge for days when a swarm of small tremors prompted scientists to warn of an elevated risk of a major earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. The alert was called off when the tremors stopped. It was a bad week for creepy clown sightings. After internet-fueled reports of people in clown costumes menacing children and women swept through at least six states and caused near riots at Penn State University and several other colleges. Police said their investigations have found that the rumored clown sightings are bogus. And it was a bad week for October surprises after WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange called a press conference to announce bombshell revelations that would devastate Hillary Clinton's presidential bid, and then said he wasn't ready to reveal anything yet and asked for donations. One disappointed Trump backer said he'd been Wiki-rolled. On the briefing page, why Obamacare is struggling. 3 years after it became law, the Affordable Care Act is facing a litany of problems. How serious are they? What are the main problems? Insurers are pulling out, premiums are rising, and many customers are being left with little or no choice of insurance plans. When it was passed in 2010, President Obama and congressional Democrats hoped the Affordable Care Act would provide uninsured Americans with private health care coverage similar to employer-sponsored plans, with federal subsidies making premiums affordable for nearly everyone. But many of the biggest providers, including Aetna, UnitedHealth, and Humana, started out with low premiums to attract customers and have lost so much money on the program that they're pulling out of most of the state health care exchanges. Only 12.7 million people enrolled on the program's online exchanges this year, 8.3 million fewer than originally forecast. As many as 19% of customers will have access to only one insurer next year. Premiums will rise by an average of 10% in 2017 and as much as 57% in some areas. Obamacare is unraveling, said Republican Senator Lamar Alexander. There's no excuse for having a failing insurance market where taxpayers are paying most of the bill. What's going wrong? Not enough younger, healthy people are signing up. The Affordable Care Act had two main provisions: the expansion of Medicaid to include more low-income families, and the individual mandate, which requires those without insurance to buy coverage. The Medicaid expansion has provided 9 million poor people with free insurance, a figure that would be considerably higher had 19 Republican-controlled states not refused to participate in the expansion. But the individual mandate has proved less successful. Under the ACA, insurers can no longer refuse to cover customers or charge them exorbitant premiums because they have a pre-existing medical condition. An individual with an income under $47,000 and a family of four making less than $97,200 qualify for graduated federal subsidies. Those who refuse to buy coverage must pay a fine of $695 or 2.5% of their salaries, whichever is higher. But premiums and deductibles can run into the thousands of dollars a year, even with subsidies. And a lot of young, healthy people are opting for the fine rather than the insurance. What effect is that having? Without the revenue from the young invincibles, who generally don't consume a lot of expensive medical care, the insurers cannot cover the medical cost of their older, sicker customers. For the system to work, 18 to 34-year-olds need to account for 35% of enrollees. Currently, they make up only 28%. Another reason for that shortfall is that, to the surprise of Obamacare architects, very few small businesses decided to drop coverage and push their workers into the exchanges. The bottom line? Insurers must either raise their premiums or leave the exchanges. Many are choosing the latter, and only providers who are profiting are offering stripped-back coverage with deductibles of $5,000 or more and very restricted lists of eligible doctors and hospitals. We're seeing the start of the Medicaidization of exchange plans, said Michael Attleberg, a health policy specialist. Narrow networks with no frills. Have any parts of Obamacare worked? Yes, its biggest success has been in providing insurance to more than 20 million Americans who lacked it. The uninsured rate has fallen from 16% in 2011 to about 9% today. Although premiums on the exchanges are rising, they're still an average of $600 a year below what they were originally projected to be. People who already have insurance are benefiting, too. Healthcare costs are rising at record low rates, in part thanks to ACA cost control provisions, including one that rewards hospitals for successful treatment and punishes them financially for readmitting patients. Overall, federal government spending on health care was $2.6 trillion less last year than it was projected to be before Obamacare, even with 20 million additional people in the system. As a result of these cost savings, premiums on employer-sponsored plans are rising by only about 4% a year, down from 10% before the legislation came into effect. How can Obamacare be improved? More young, healthy people will have to sign up. Congress could provide incentives by amending the law to impose higher penalties and provide larger subsidies, as well as tighten the rules to prevent people from signing up the moment they get sick. Some healthcare experts advocate embracing the narrow network strategy to offer young people the option of cheaper, bare-bones coverage to protect them in the event of an accident or serious illness. But any fix will require the approval of congressional Republicans, who have been fiercely opposed to Obamacare since its inception and are committed to seeing it die. As long as the GOP controls at least one branch of the government, the party will block any attempts to make it work better. I remember the victory dance Democrats performed after passing Obamacare without a single Republican vote, said GOP Senator John McCain. Now the chickens have come home to roost. The Republican alternative. Congressional Republicans have tried to repeal Obamacare more than 60 times, yet they have never provided a detailed proposal for a replacement. The closest they've come is a rough outline of a plan unveiled by House Speaker Paul Ryan in June. The main provisions are eliminating the individual mandate, replacing subsidies with tax credits not linked to income so that the poor can get them, and continuing the ban on insurers discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, but only if they maintain continuous coverage. For sick people without coverage, Ryan would create a high-risk pool whose expensive premiums individual states could subsidize. The GOP proposal is very fuzzy on the details, with no estimates for cost, how generous the tax credits would be, or, crucially, how many people would be forced off Medicaid or subsidized policies. The hard part for Republicans is going to be the millions of people who did not have coverage before who now have coverage, says Bill Hoagland from the Bipartisan Policy Center. I think that's going to be a difficult row to hoe. In this issue of the Week magazine, we have a special report that's titled Clinton and Trump, the Candidates' Positions. It's fairly in-depth and goes into positions on different topics. And we're going to go ahead and work through that whole special report and then circle back to see which of our regulars we can get in the time remaining. So Clinton and Trump, the Candidates' Positions. The 2016 presidential election is shaping up to be one of the most fiercely fought and divisive in modern American history. Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump are both polarizing figures with record-setting unfavorable ratings. Though Trump's positions on most issues have been vague and changeable, it's clear the two candidates would take the country in dramatically different directions. With that in mind, here's a look at where the candidates stand on 10 important issues. Immigration. Clinton has vowed to introduce a comprehensive immigration bill within her first 100 days in office. She says border security has already been enhanced, giving us the most secure border we have ever had. Clinton wants to provide a path to legalization for the nation's 11 million undocumented immigrants. She will prioritize deporting only those who commit violent crimes. Trump's proposals on immigration are among his most detailed policy positions. He has promised to deport a large percentage of the 11 million, focusing on those who've overstayed their visas or who have committed any crimes. To prevent further crossings, he plans to build a massive wall along more than 1,000 miles of the Mexican-U.S. border and somehow force Mexico to pay for it. Trump has also said he would triple the number of immigration and customs enforcement officers, crack down on those who overstay a visa, and end sanctuary cities. He's also pledged to block accepting refugees from Syria and other countries with a proven history of terrorism, saying only those who undergo an extreme vetting of their political and religious views should be admitted. The Supreme Court. The next president could drastically remake the composition of the Supreme Court, filling as many as four vacancies over the next 4 years. Justice Antonin Scalia's seat has remained unoccupied since he died in February, and three other justices, liberals Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, and swing vote Anthony Kennedy, are in their late 70s or early 80s. The Republican leadership in the Senate has refused to consider President Obama's nominee to replace Scalia. Merrick Garland, a center-left appellate court judge many GOP lawmakers supported in the past. Clinton has not said whether she would stick with Garland if she's elected, but has promised to look broadly and widely for people who represent the diversity of our country when picking potential replacements. Her nominees are sure to share her progressive values. Trump has said he would look for nominees in the mold of Scalia, a constitutional originalist who said justices should base their rulings on the language and intent of the founding fathers and lawmakers. In May, Trump released a short list of 11 potential picks that included former clerks for Scalia and Justice Clarence Thomas, another conservative stalwart. Trump recently added 11 more conservatives to that list. Healthcare. In the past, the GOP nominee has praised the idea of a single-payer system and said health care is a right. But as a candidate, Trump has called the Affordable Care Act a disaster, horrendous, and an incredible economic burden, and has vowed to ask Congress to repeal the ACA on the first day of his presidency. He says he will replace it with a great health care plan, but hasn't explained in any detail what it will be or how many of the 20 million people insured through Obamacare would lose their insurance. One hint, he has proposed allowing people to deduct health insurance premiums they buy from their income tax as a way of subsidizing a more free market approach. Like House Speaker Paul Ryan, Trump favors a block grant approach to Medicaid, meaning he would give a pot of money to each state to use at its discretion. In contrast, Clinton wants to build on Obamacare and fix its flaws by putting more money into subsidizing premiums so that more young, healthy people sign up. The Democratic nominee would also offer Americans a public option health care plan and expand Medicare to allow those ages 55 and older to opt into the program. Energy and climate change. Trump wants to unleash a treasure trove of untapped energy by reviving the coal industry, opening up more federal land and offshore waters to drilling, and overturning environmental regulations designed to limit pollutants and greenhouse gas emissions. He has dismissed climate change as a Chinese plot to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive, and said he'd seek to cancel the International Paris Climate Agreement. Clinton says climate change is a major threat to the world and pledges to turn the U.S. into the world's clean energy superpower. She has proposed ending subsidies to oil and gas companies, subsidizing the purchase of 500 million solar panels for homes and businesses, and upgrading the electrical grid to handle more wind, solar, and geothermal power. Clinton would uphold the Paris Accord and seek to put the U.S. on a path to reduce emissions by 30% by 2025. Gun control. As First Lady during her husband's presidency and then as a senator for New York, Clinton was a strong proponent of federal gun regulations. In this campaign, she has positioned herself as the gun violence prevention candidate. She supports reinstating the ban on the sale of assault weapons, requiring background checks to be completed before any gun sale goes through, and mandating those checks for gun show sales, which are now exempted. The Democrat also wants to repeal a law that shields gun makers from liability and pass a law banning those on the no-fly list and domestic abusers from buying firearms. Trump's stance on gun control also has evolved through the years. The Republican nominee wrote in 2000 that though he generally opposed gun control, he supported the assault weapon ban passed by Congress in 1994 and was in favor of longer waiting periods. Today, he's ardently pro-Second Amendment, calling gun control laws and gun-free zones a total failure. He wants to allow people to carry guns at schools and on military bases, and to require all 50 states to honor concealed carry permits from other states. He told a meeting of the National Rifle Association in May, "The only way to save our Second Amendment is to vote for a person that you all know, named Donald Trump." Reproductive rights. Clinton is strongly pro-choice and has advocated for an end to the Hyde Amendment, which bans the use of federal Medicaid dollars to fund abortions. In June, she pointedly chose to make her first real general election speech about reproductive rights and told supporters, "I've been proud to stand with Planned Parenthood for a long time, and as president, I will always have your back." Despite declaring in 1999 that he's very pro-choice, Trump says he has evolved on the issue and is now totally against abortion, except to save the life of the mother or in the case of rape or incest. Trump promises to choose pro-life justices for the Supreme Court and defund Planned Parenthood if it doesn't stop performing abortions. His running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, has promised that the Roe v. Wade decision will be consigned to the ash heap of history if Trump is elected. Taxes. Clinton's tax proposal is designed to raise revenue for infrastructure spending and expanded social programs and would hike taxes on high-income households. Her proposals include a 4% fair share surcharge on taxpayers making more than $5 million a year, the closure of a number of loopholes that allow the wealthiest Americans to shelter their money in tax havens, and a 30% minimum tax rate on households making at least $2 million a year. She also plans to crack down on corporate inversions, the practice of moving a company's headquarters overseas to avoid taxes in the United States, and earnings stripping, which allows multinationals to move their profits to countries with lower tax rates. Trump, on the other hand, promises the biggest tax reform since Reagan. He would cut the number of brackets from 7 to 3 and drop the rate for the highest earners from 39.6% to 33%. Under a Trump presidency, the estate tax would be eliminated and the top federal corporate tax rate, which currently stands at 35%, would drop to 15%. Education. Clinton's education plan includes policy prescriptions for every stage of development. She wants to establish universal preschool and double the government's investment in early Head Start. Regarding K-12 education, Clinton says overly punitive disciplinary measures have helped create a school-to-prison pipeline that damages impoverished communities. She wants to spend $2 billion to give schools the resources to expand behavioral support programs and help nonviolent problem students rather than punishing them with suspensions. Clinton also wants to make tuition at in-state four-year public colleges and universities free for families earning less than $125,000. Trump has proposed $20 billion in federal grants to support school choice for low-income families. The money would be dispersed to the states, which would then distribute the funds based on where the children were enrolling. Trump says he would eliminate Common Core, the K-12 academic standards developed by a coalition of state education leaders, calling that program a total disaster. Trade. Trump has advocated imposing tariffs on imports to level the playing field for American companies. On an American car company that moved its production to Mexico, he would levy a 35% tax. For goods from China, he has proposed imposing a tariff as high as 45%, though he later said he might simply threaten to impose large tariffs to make other nations play by the rules. Trump has also indicated that he would renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement or withdraw from it altogether to get a better deal for U.S. workers. As First Lady, Clinton supported NAFTA and other trade agreements, but once she became a U.S. senator, her record on free trade was mixed. She voted against the Dominican Republican Central America Free Trade Agreement, but supported several bilateral trade agreements, including ones with Singapore, Australia, and Oman. Both Clinton and Trump say they are against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 12-nation deal that would eliminate more than 18,000 tariffs. As Secretary of State, Clinton praised the TPP as the gold standard in trade agreements. She changed that position during her bruising primary fight with Bernie Sanders, who, like Trump, blames trade deals for taking American jobs. National security. Both Trump and Clinton pledge to root out terrorists and defeat ISIS. In the wake of the Orlando nightclub shooting, Clinton called for an intelligence surge to identify radicalized people in the U.S. She says she'll continue the war against ISIS and other terrorist groups with a mix of airstrikes, support for local forces, and diplomacy. Trump says he has a secret plan to defend ISIS that he will not reveal so as not to tip off the terrorists, and occasionally vows to bomb the hell out of ISIS and take the oil. In dealing with other conflicts, Trump has refused to take the use of nuclear weapons off the table and said that the U.S. should support more nations, including Japan and Saudi Arabia, becoming nuclear powers so that the U.S. doesn't have to shoulder the financial burden for their defense. After the Democrats and Republican national conventions wrapped up in August, Hillary Clinton opened a comfortable lead in the polls of 6-8%. Pundits were predicting that former Secretary of State would beat Donald Trump in a landslide. 2 months later, the landscape has changed. Polls tightened, especially in key battlegrounds where Trump and Clinton are fighting for the lead. Now Clinton has regained a significant lead, but unpredictable events could change the race again. Here's a look at the five most important swing states, which will be crucial to winning the White House in November. Florida. With 29 electoral votes up for grabs, Florida is perhaps the most important battleground in this election. The conventions gave Clinton a decent bump here, but in mid-September, amid news reports about her pneumonia diagnosis and the Clinton Foundation's potential conflicts of interest, Trump erased that lead. But after the first debate and a week of unremitting bad news for Trump, Clinton has surged back into a 2.8-point lead in the RealClearPolitics.com aggregation of multiple polls. A new Newsweek story reporting that Trump may have violated the U.S. embargo against Castro's Cuba by trying to do business there in the 1990s might hurt him with a crucial voting bloc, anti-Castro Cubans in Miami. President Barack Obama barely beat Mitt Romney in the state in 2012, eking out a victory by 0.9%. What makes Florida, a state with a Republican governor and a GOP-led legislature, so competitive? The state has roughly the same number of registered Republicans and Democrats. Another 3.3 million voters remain independent of any party affiliation. Clinton is hoping to win big among the state's large Hispanic population, and is reportedly spending 50 times more money on television ads than her GOP rival. If she wins Florida, Trump's path to the 270 electoral votes becomes extremely narrow. Ohio. Ohio is a critical state for Trump. Ohio's manufacturing sector has been hit hard by both the forces of economic globalization and the 2008 financial crisis, making the state an important test for whether the Republicans' vow to bring back lost jobs from abroad will resonate with the electorate, especially white working-class voters. Trump is campaigning heavily in the state, making 9 stops here in the past month. No Republican has ever won the presidency without winning Ohio, which has 18 electoral votes and has backed the winner in 28 of the last 30 elections. Clinton, on the other hand, is hoping to keep President Obama's winning streak in the last 2 elections here going. With polls showing Trump opening a lead of 4 or more points, her campaign is now saying she doesn't need Ohio to get to 270 electoral votes. Clinton hasn't given up on the state, campaigning there this week and sending her husband Bill to appeal to working-class voters. North Carolina. The past 6 years saw the Tar Heel state turn from purple to bright red as voters installed Republican majorities in the state legislature, elected Republican Governor Pat McCrory, chose Romney over Obama, and ousted Democratic Senator Kay Hagan. But the consolidation of power led to HB2, one of the more controversial bills to come out of a state house in recent years. The so-called bathroom bill has upended North Carolina politics, as the fallout from the legislation has caused a number of organizations to boycott the state. The recent protests and rioting after the police shooting of a black man in Charlotte have deepened divisions. Young college-educated voters and older evangelical voters are now engaged in a furious battle over North Carolina's future. Clinton, who hopes to inspire a big turnout by African Americans and young liberals, has heavily invested in her ground game here and is operating more than 30 campaign offices. Trump recently opened a campaign office in the state and plans to air ads here. RealClearPolitics.com shows the race essentially tied. Pennsylvania. Clinton almost certainly has to win Pennsylvania and its 20 electoral votes to reach the White House. For months, she had a double-digit lead in the state. But in the RealClearPolitics.com average, it's dwindled to just 3.5 points. Her campaign is spending close to $19 million on television ads here in the last several weeks of the election. Trump is spending $1.5 million. While both Obama and Vice President Joe Biden have been dispatched to fire up the Democratic supporters. The eastern part of the Keystone State is especially voter-rich for Clinton, who chose to deliver a speech appealing to millennials from Philadelphia, a city where Obama won 85% of the vote in 2012. The state's big urban centers, with their large percentage of black voters, lean heavily Democratic. But Trump's anti-immigrant, anti-trade, pro-coal platform appeals to the mostly white rural parts of the state between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And finally, Nevada. Obama comfortably won Nevada in 2008 and 2012, but this year's race for the 6 electoral votes of the westernmost swing state is shaping up to be much closer. Despite a large and growing Hispanic population, Trump has been polling well in the Silver State, which was hit hard by job losses and foreclosures in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. The slower recovery and the low number of college graduates, fewer than a quarter of the Nevadans have bachelor's degrees, play to Trump's strength this election cycle. His populist message has been well received in a state that has an unemployment rate of 6.3%, 1.4% above the national average. Polls have seesawed in recent weeks, but this week showed Clinton with a slight lead. Clinton is counting on the fact that there are about 107,000 more registered Democrats than registered Republicans in Nevada, and she has the backing of the powerful state party machine built by Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. We'll read one of the obituaries now. The Israeli statesman who never gave up on peace, Shimon Peres, 1923 to 2016. Shimon Peres was present at nearly every momentous event in Israel's seven-decade history. He was a young aide to the country's founding fathers when independence was declared in 1948, and he went on to hold almost every major government office, including as president, prime minister, three times, and defense minister. Peres helped Israel become the dominant Middle Eastern military power, but he also pushed hard for peace, sharing a 1994 Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through the Oslo Accords. Dapper and cultured, Peres was known as a skilled plotter. Former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, a longtime rival, called him an inveterate schemer. But in his last years, Israelis revered him as a pillar of the nation. "For 60 years, I was the most controversial figure in the country," Peres said. "Truth be told, I don't know when I was happier, then or now." He was born Shimon Persky to a merchant family in the village of Vishnua, Poland, said the New York Times. He immigrated to British-ruled Palestine at age 11 with his parents, and in 1941 helped found a kibbutz where he worked as a herdsman. Peres became active in the precursor to Israel's Labor Party, and in 1944, his mentor, David Ben-Gurion, sent him to map the Sinai Desert, reconnaissance that proved vital in the 1948 War of Independence. While in the Sinai, he spotted a nest of eagles and adopted the Hebrew word for eagle, Peres, as his family name. When Ben-Gurion became Israel's first prime minister in 1948, Peres was named Secretary of the Navy, and 4 years later, at 29, was appointed head of the Defense Ministry. He set out to make Israel a major military force, said the Washington Post. Peres negotiated with Germany for arms, cultivated a secret alliance with France, fathered Israel's aircraft industry, and made his country a nuclear power by building a 24,000-kilowatt reactor in the Negev Desert. He was elected to Israel's parliament in 1959, but suffered a setback when Ben-Gurion suddenly resigned as prime minister in 1963. Peres languished on the opposition benches as Israel won sweeping victories over its Arab neighbors in 1967's Six-Day War, said the Times. Following Golda Meir's resignation as prime minister in 1974, Peres unsuccessfully battled Rabin for the vacant post. Appointed defense minister by Rabin, Peres dedicated himself to strengthening Israel's military and supporting Jewish settlements in the West Bank. When Palestinian terrorists seized an Air France flight from Tel Aviv to Paris and landed it at Uganda's Entebbe Airport in 1976, Peres helped devise the daring commando raid that freed some 100 mainly Israeli hostages. It was an operation that won international admiration. After a scandal hit Rabin resigned in 1977, Peres served as acting prime minister for barely a month before Labor was trounced at the polls by Menachem Begin's Likud party. Peres suffered five further election defeats, said BBC.com. But in 1984, he finally became prime minister through a power-sharing deal with Likud that required him to step aside after 2 years. When Rabin returned to power in 1992, Peres served as foreign minister, and the two men conducted secret negotiations with Yasser Arafat, the leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. The talks culminated in 1993's Oslo Accords, which outlined a framework for Israeli-Palestinian peace. "Let all of us turn from bullets to ballots," Peres said at a White House signing ceremony. "Peace never came," said the Los Angeles Times. Rabin was assassinated at a 1995 rally by a Jewish extremist, and Peres, who took over as prime minister, lost the 1996 election to the more hawkish Benjamin Netanyahu, following a series of terrorist attacks inside Israel. Peres was elected president in 2007, a post which he played a quiet mediating role between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama. He finally left office in 2014, but never completely retired from public life and continued to work at the Peace Center that bears his name in Tel Aviv. "I have one weakness," he said in November. "I don't like vacations." On the health and science page, the baby with three biological parents. A baby boy with genetic information from three parents has been born with the help of a controversial new in vitro fertilization technique. The procedure, called mitochondrial transfer, was created to prevent women with genetic mutations from passing along devastating diseases to their children. The first beneficiaries were a Jordanian couple who had lost two previous children and four pregnancies to Leigh syndrome, a fatal disorder that affects the developing nervous system. To enable them to have a healthy baby, New York-based fertility specialist Dr. John Zhang took the nucleus from one of the woman's eggs and inserted it into the healthy donor's egg that had had its own nucleus removed. The resulting egg contains the donor's mitochondria, but genetic information from the mother that will determine traits like eye and hair color. It was then fertilized with sperm from the father. About 99.9% of the embryo's DNA came from his mother and father, with a tiny percentage from the donor mitochondria. The boy, now 6 months old, is healthy, but his birth has sparked criticism, since three-parent embryo techniques are banned in the U.S. because of fears they might lead to genetic abnormalities. Zhang performed this procedure in Mexico and tells New Scientist he was justified in what he did. "To save lives is the ethical thing to do," he said. Happy wife, healthy life. New research adds credibility to the old saying, "happy wife, happy life," suggesting that men and women with happy spouses are not only happier, but also healthier. For the study, researchers analyzed data compiled on nearly 2,000 middle-aged heterosexual couples whose happiness and physical health were tracked for 6 years. They found that those whose spouses had a positive outlook were 34% more likely to be healthy, exercise regularly, and eat healthfully, and have positive outlooks themselves. Those with a pessimistic partner, on the other hand, had more health issues and were less physically active. Why? The researchers speculate that when one member of a couple adopts good lifestyle habits, that person encourages his or her spouse to do the same. Spouses with a positive outlook also cause less stress in the relationship, the study's lead author, William Chopik, tells Time.com. "Simply having a happy partner," he said, "may enhance health as much as striving to be happy oneself." On the Talking Points page, 9/11 bill, why Congress has regrets. "What a classic example of chutzpah," said Michael McGough in the Los Angeles Times. Congress last week handed President Obama the first veto override of his two terms, upholding legislation that will enable 9/11 survivors and families to sue the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in U.S. courts for allegedly helping the al-Qaeda terrorists. Obama had opposed the law because it would overturn long-standing international precedents preventing citizens from suing foreign governments, thereby exposing the U.S. to tit-for-tat lawsuits in other countries. Iraqis, for example, could sue the U.S. for killing their family members during the war. Immediately after the override, Republican lawmakers experienced buyer's remorse and said they might need to amend the bill. Nobody really had focused on the potential downside, said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Republicans then blamed Obama for inadequately explaining the flaws of the bill he vetoed. That took some gall, like the boy who kills his parents, then pleads for mercy at his trial because he's an orphan. Still, Obama does share some blame, said James Taranto in the Wall Street Journal. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker says that the White House refused repeated requests to meet with senators to hash out concerns over the bill. Now the override is being blamed on Republicans, but the bill had huge support on both sides of the aisle, 97-1 in the Senate and 348-77 in the House. The fact is, Obama has always disdained working with Congress. Perhaps lawmakers would have avoided this mistake if he had done the hard work of private persuasion that he seems to think beneath him. Lawmakers knew perfectly well they were enacting deeply flawed legislation, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. But in a typical act of political pandering, Congress ignored Obama and overrode the veto anyway. Who wants to stiff 9/11 families a few weeks before Election Day? After all this, 9/11 families may not be able to sue after all, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. To be able to sue the Saudis under our Constitution, the plaintiffs would have to show that the Saudi government had knowingly taken actions in the U.S. that resulted in harm to Americans. Right now, according to the 9/11 Commission report, no clear-cut evidence of Saudi government involvement exists. In the end, this law may turn out to be an empty symbolic gesture. And that leaves us just enough time to wrap up with a quote. And why not Mark Twain, who says, "Get your facts first, then you can distort them as you please." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the show at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.